Welcome to Worlds Apart. The old Vladimir Lenin's maxim, show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are, couldn't be more relevant today, especially in the context of the war-torn Ukraine. Not only politics, but an entire worldview can be deducted from where one stands on the conflict. How much do these fault lines influence front lines? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Emmanuel Pieterborn, an Italian author and political consultant. Mr. Pieterborn, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, I know that for you, the conflict in Ukraine is not just about Ukraine or its territory. You wrote recently that it's a battlefield where the West, Russia, and other big players are fighting over their versions of a new world order. I wonder if this transition to a new world order is inevitable, or do you think it can actually be averted if one of the sides, specifically the West, prevails?
In my opinion, the transition to multipolarity is inevitable. And the eventual defeat of Russia could only slow down the decline of the Western dominion over the world. And the reasons are several, and all of them have to do with the West. Mm-hmm. I'm not only speaking about the loss of reputational credibility, the loss of economic influence over the world, or the rise of China, for instance. I'm speaking about the West. I'm speaking about the cancel culture, and speaking about the demographic crisis, the regular outbreak of economic crisis within the West, and the more and more the increased level of radicalization and fragmentation of Western society. Mm-hmm. So there is an ensemble of reason, and all of these reasons have to do with the West, which in my opinion, and not only in my opinion, but also the opinion of several political scientists, will inevitably lead to the decline of the Western dominion over the world.
Well, I think some in the West, especially among the liberal camp, they are also hoping for a transition to a brand new world, but it is sort of a transition back to the future. For example, Francis Fukuyama, a prominent American political scientist, who was a frequent guest and a very influential figure in Kyiv over the last couple of years. He wrote recently that a Russian defeat will make possible a new birth of freedom and that it will allow to renew the spirit of 1989. Putting aside that probability, why do you think that spirit of 1989, the falling Berlin Wall, the collapsing Soviet Union, this emerging American unipolarity, why do you think it was so short-lived?
The spirit of 89 was so short-lived because, as you said, it was led by the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it wasn't truly genuine. It was dollar-driven, let's say so. And I'm not saying it was manufactured, because it wasn't, but it was mainly led by the rise of the unipolar moment. And as soon as the world experienced the unfairness and the many brutalities of the unipolar moment, in particular, the war on terror, the bombing on Belgrade, the world started turning illiberal overnight. So it wasn't about Russia, because Russia at that time was weak, was plenty of internal problem. It wasn't about China, which was focused on internal growth. It was for other reasons. So I can't agree with Fukuyama and the spirit of 89, because actually, as I said, this spirit was mainly dollar driven, and it ended very shortly.
Regardless of the outcome of this battle for, you know, a brand new world, the United States will remain a very influential country. Whatever they do, they will still be a major player, a supreme player. Why do you think they are going to such great length and frankly such risks now in openly confronting Russia when they, you know, to get something that they already haven't abandoned? Why, what is it exactly that they are after?
The thing is that European and American geopolitics has a lot to do with Eurasia. So the United States is already the first major power of the world. But in order to keep being a global empire, the US is, let's say, obliged to exert some kind of divide and rule over Eurasia, because as Cyril Ford Mackinder said, and you know, Mackinder is the founding father of geopolitics, who rules over Eurasia rules over the world. So for the US, it's not matter of merely confronting Russia. It's matter of keeps being the major power over Eurasia, because the dominion over Eurasia gives the United States the lead over the world.
You also mentioned in one of your recent articles that the Biden administration in their policy vis-a-vis Ukraine and their stance on the Ukrainian conflict is trying to kill two birds with one stone: undermine Russia, as you said, but also weaken the Berlin-Paris axis, that is to reduce the influence of those political forces in Europe who are in favor of Europe's larger autonomy, strategic autonomy from the United States. How advanced is Washington at this point in accomplishing these two goals?
Well, I think the Biden administration achieved the goal, because the party, the European Party of Strategic Autonomy, has been put to sleep. Nobody is talking about this tension, the tent with Russia. They are only speaking about a ceasefire at best. And the decoupling, which was very, very important, was done. The economic decoupling between the European market and Russian market has been done. Mm-hmm. For the energy decoupling, it will be a matter of months, of years, but it will take place. And as you know, the Nord Stream 2 is dead. Mm-hmm. And then we have NATO, which some years ago was defined as brain dead by Macron, but now is more alive than ever before. And seems like it is even going to be enlarged with the entry of Sweden and Finland. So from my point of view, Biden administration has already achieved the goal.
It's true that the Americans are moving very fast in terms of their strategic objectives, but I think it's only starting to dawn on the Europeans how much they will have to pay for that in, you know, literal terms, you know, every single European citizen, you know, at supermarket or at a gas station, but also in strategic and tactical terms, as the costs of these policies become more clear to the European people. Do you think you know, those results that the Americans have achieved for now, do you think they could be sustained?
Let's start from this. Nothing lasts forever. So when I speak about Biden administration achieving the goal, I'm speaking about the short, or at the best, the mid-term. And for the short and the mid-term, there can be no peace, no approachment between the European Union and Russia. This is more than sure. About the cost, the long-term sustainability, this is very interesting. Actually, the United States hoped for Le Pen's victory at the recent French elections, because Macron is seen as an obstacle between the American agenda for Europe and the European agenda for Europe, because Macron is the mastermind of the strategic autonomy. Macron is the one who wants, right now, the only one, apart from Pope Francis and Orban, is the only one who wants dialogue with Russia. So, you know, Macron will be the major obstacle in the years to come, even because Macron is closely tied to Germany. And also Germany, more in detail, Scholz and Angela Merkel, they hoped for Macron's re-election, because Macron's re-election will give life to the Paris-Berlin axis. And from the Paris-Berlin axis depends the future of Europe, and of course the future of Europe-Russia relations.
Can I ask you specifically about the economic sanctions? Because you wrote recently that these economic sanctions against Moscow were both unprecedented and planned in advance, but I'm seeing more and more Western analysts suggesting that the scale of the sanctions, and specifically the effect on third countries, how painful it is to the rest of the world, may be the biggest Achilles heel, and that it may actually come back to hurt the United States. Do you think that they are indeed so well planned? Do you think the United States calculated accurately the rest of the world's ability and willingness to carry the burden of the American decision?
I did write that they were very long planned and unprecedented, but I also added something. They were mainly directed against the European Union, and only at a second level they were and they are aimed at weakening Russia. Why? Because the United States is well aware of one fact. No one can expel Russia from the global markets. You simply can't, because Russia is not North Korea, Russia is not Cuba. Russia is the major producer and exporter of energy goods all over the world. And secondly, as I said, the main goal, the main target was to weaken the European Union. Why? Because the European Union for the United States is, yes, a military ally, but is also an economic rival. So the sanction regime was long planned and carefully studied to weaken the European Union. And indeed, the first target of the sanctions regime, as you know, was the Nord Stream 2. So Biden did what Obama couldn't.
Now, for many years, American political scientists criticized Russia for using crude power and extolled the American ability to exercise soft or smart power. That is, when other players bend to America's will, not because they are forced to, but because they genuinely want to or find it beneficial for themselves. Do you think they use image as a dispenser of the global common good and an author or an advocate of universal rules and values? Do you think it will change as a result of this whole Ukrainian affair?
In my opinion, it doesn't matter who wins the Ukraine war, because the reputational crisis of the United States cannot be solved. And I mean, not now, not in the years to come, because the United States administration made too many mistakes in the recent years. And firstly, I mentioned the war on terror. You know, the war on terror had an incredible impact, not only in the rest of the world, but also on the West. For instance, in my country, in Italy, the impact on the public opinion was very huge. And there was a growth, an incredible growth of anti-Americanism in the wake of the war on terror, because of the death of Saddam Hussein, because of the death of Muammar Gaddafi, which was one of Italy's best allies, you know, and he was wildly killed. I think the image of the United States is undermined. They undermined it themselves. It was undermined by themselves. And the outcome of this war, of this peace, of the Third World War in peace, will not impact significantly on the image of the United States. On the contrary, it will further polarize the world in blocks.
Okay, well, Mr. Peter Bond, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Only one main thing is important for Nazism, internationally speaking, and that is that nations that are allowed to do anything are the master races. And then you have the minor nations who are the slaves.
Americans, Barack Obama and others, have had a concept of American exceptionalism.
International law exists as long as it serves American interests. If it doesn't, it doesn't exist.
By turning those Russians into this dangerous boogeyman that wants to take over the world. That was a conscious strategy.
Zusammenbruch der Sowjetunion eigentlich wie eine Art Filetstück auf dem silbernen Tablett lag.
NATO said, ha, it's ours, we move east.
The reason U.S. hegemony is so dangerous is it denies the sovereignty of other countries.
The exceptionalism that America uses in its international war planning is one of the greatest threats to the populations of different nations.
If NATO were disbanded, shareholders in the United States and elsewhere in large arms companies would lose millions and millions.
War is business and business is good. And that is the reality of what we're facing, which is fascism.
Apart with Emmanuel Pieterbon, an Italian author and political consultant. Mr. Pieterbon, before the break, we talked about this transition to a new world order and Russia's grievances with the current system of American dominance are well known. I think they're almost ontological in nature, but you suggested that much of the global South also has a stake in this transition. What are the potential benefits in dethroning Washington for the rest of the globe, excluding Russia?
Many benefits. Let's only think about one thing. Many of Washington's most trusted allies, historical allies, like India, Saudi Arabia, and Brazil, and Brazil is very vulnerable in light of its position because it's capable in Americas, have decided to side with Russia. They didn't answer to Biden's call to arms against Russia. Why they did so? Because the unipolarity is also a limit for them, for their global aspiration. So they are siding with Russia because we are before the West against the rest. And the West, all this time, since the end of the Cold War, ignored the interest of the rest of the world. This is why Biden was surprised by the refusals coming from countries like Saudi Arabia and Brazil. But many political analysts like me weren't surprised at all. The rest of the world is watching this war and is siding with Russia because the eventual defeat of the West, not on military terms, but on diplomatic terms and also on economic terms. Because if you don't join the sanctions regime against Russia, you are siding with Russia implicitly. So the rest of the world is siding with Russia, hopefully, to catalyze the multipolar transition.
Now, you also suggested that Ukraine is both a battlefield and a negotiating table for the already ongoing third world war in pieces. That's a very interesting phrase. What exactly do you mean, and how is it different from the previous world wars?
Well, when I speak about the third world war in peace, I'm using a concept which was popularized by Pope Francis in the wake of the Syrian civil war. And it is what political scientists used to call great power competition, what the press has renamed the Cold War II. And it is different compared to the previous world war because it is informal. The great powers are at war, but this war is covert, and they are fighting across the globe by means sometimes of the color revolutions, civil wars, terrorism. There is a lot of terrorism and new kind of weapons like cyber attacks and cognitive wars. So it's much more different than in the past.
Mm-hmm. I think you also mentioned that there is, in one of your articles, that there is a shift towards the peripheries, that the many of the hostilities start at the peripheries. And that got me thinking about Tolkien's books, in which protagonists first fight for their own land, and then they come together to fight for the so-called Middle Earth. And to some extent, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Turkey, Syria, they are all sort of middle lands. They are positioned right between other big players, and potentially they have a lot to gain, but also a lot to lose. I think the case of Afghanistan is a very good one. It's a very rich country in terms of mineral resources. It's located geographically in a very advantageous position, but for decades it's been ravaged by conflict. What do you think is a smart strategy in this day and age for such Middle Earth powers? How should they, conduct their policy to maximize the benefit and minimize the chances for conflict?
Well, the best strategy could be the following: dialogue with everyone, alignment with no one. But we are in the middle of the third world war in pieces. So, no great power, not even Russia, will accept from these powers a full non-alignment. If I were Turkey, if I were Kazakhstan, I would suggest, you want to invest in my country? Okay, you are welcome. You want to use that money to politically influence me? Your money is not welcome. But it will be very hard. And the Ukraine war has been the watershed moment of our era. And it will worsen the position of a lot of geostrategically positioned countries, like, as you said, Kazakhstan, Turkey, Afghanistan, but not only them. And it will be very hard, much harder than today, to be non-aligned, to be neutral.
Now, we mentioned Pope Francis a couple of times, and he is an interesting figure. He's been involved in the Ukrainian conflict diplomatically since its very beginning. Some of that involvement was quite controversial. For example, a couple of weeks ago, he posed with a nationalist, Ukrainian nationalist, some would even say neo-Nazi banner, but a few days ago he made some very bold and I would say politically incorrect statements about this war, saying that it was caused by, quote, NATO barking at Russia's door, which he said caused the Kremlin to, quote, react badly and unleash the conflict. What's the significance of the statement like this coming from one of the world's and one of the West's most prominent spiritual leaders? I cannot think about any other, you know, leader of the so-called Western world to say something along those lines.
I wasn't surprised at all when I read the Pope's statement, because the Pope, let's say, is a Putin's fan. Pope Francis, just like his predecessor, is a fan of the multipolar transition. and they paved the way for a normalization of the whole Syria-Russia relations. Why they did so? Because they acknowledged the fact that the West cannot be re-Christianized again. The West is lost. The West entered the post-Christian era. And the Holy See is both a political and a spiritual power. I think it is the only purely spiritual power of the world. And so the Vatican thinks about politics, economics, but also about spirituality. And Francis, just like his predecessor, saw in Russia the so-called biblical catechon against the civilizational decline in favor of re-Christianization and traditional values. This is why the Holy See has tried in the recent years to approach to Russia and has distanced itself from the West. For instance, the Holy See backed Russia's operation in Syria. The Holy See tried to normalize relations with Venezuela. The Holy See supported Iran and played a role during the Obama era in the signing of the nuclear deal. And this is why the Holy See right now is trying to escalate the tension, the crisis between the West and Russia, and by means of those very strong declarations, because they are very strong, Pope Francis sent a signal to both Europe, the United States, and Russia. The Holy See wants peace and would like to be part of the peace agreement.
You said that you weren't surprised by Pope Francis's statement, but as I was reading American accounts of it and the analysis of it, I think there was a lot of dismay, a lot of anger, some questioning of the Pope's cognitive ability and his wisdom. Do you think Washington will now introduce sanctions against the Holy See? Because clearly what the Pope is saying goes very vividly against what the Biden administration and the rest of the West is trying to push as the truth.
Well, you know, sanctions are the best tool of the United States foreign policy. So they could try to sanction the Pope. I think the United States, more pragmatically, will further widen the distance with the Holy See. They will not do it openly, but they will put forward the Protestantization agenda in the rest of the world, because against the background of the Third World War in pieces, against the background of the West-Russia confrontation, of the Sino-American confrontation, there is another war taking place across the globe. And it is the war inside the Christianity. There is Catholicism against Protestant churches. And the global growth of Protestant churches is mainly driven by the United States. So the United States might well reply to the Pope's strong position favoring Russia by further funding and accelerating the Protestantization of several countries.
Well, Mr. Pieterbon, this is a very interesting conversation. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but the only thing I would say is that regardless of which confession, Christian confession we belong to, or even which religion we belong to, because many Abrahamic religions have very similar themes, as the Bible says, blessed are peacemakers because they will be called children of God. Let's hope Pope Francis or whoever wants to make a contribution to resolving this conflict will succeed. But for the time being, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Fully agree with you, and thank you very much again for the invitation.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.